From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, we'll learn about an effort to help ideas coming out of the UW system advance past the idea stage. Later, a charter school hits its stride as it hits the 10-year mark.
I think that now we're getting the commitment of our staff to stay. They know where we're going. They know how we're trying to get there. When it wasn't so clear, people had more of a tendency to go.
A recent book highlights Milwaukee County parks, plus the argument for paying close attention to the health of your feet.
Our feet are our foundation. They're our basement for our house. They can cause ailments up the ladder, knees, hips, even back pain.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Great to have you listening this morning. In the science world, the term translational medicine is applied to the work that takes basic science and turns it into the things that help treat or prevent disease. And billions of dollars go into this translational medicine each year. But while Wisconsin's universities turn out a good deal of basic research in the health sciences, they also generate many more ideas in other fields, some of which are commercialized and some of which never get past the idea stage. A seed fund just launched represents a partnership between the UW Extension Service and the state's Economic Development Commission. Idea Advance hopes to take ideas generated at state universities and put them in a position to be commercially viable. Mark Lang is Executive Director for Entrepreneurship and Economic Development for UW Extension, and David Voles manages the Entrepreneurship Program at WEDC. They both join us by phone. Voles explains the gap this fund seeks to address.
In Wisconsin, we have a pretty healthy and active angel investor climate. There's a lot of private angel investors, you know, for a state of this size, but there's little seed funding available for an entrepreneur. The seed funding that is necessary to help that entrepreneur develop his or her business to that next stage where private investors typically come in. So Idea Advance is an effort to address that gap that exists right now between the point where somebody has a great idea and that stage that's going to be down the road when that idea and that company is mature enough for a private investment to come in.
Is that really Is that the case in the UW system? Are there ideas that are just dying at the idea stage because no seed money exists to advance them beyond that?
I think we believe that there are. There are probably a lot more opportunities for those ideas to find funding and find legs, maybe in Madison with the culture that's developed there. But we think there's a huge opportunity that there's two things going on there. There's pockets of information of entrepreneurial activity on these comprehensive other campuses around the state that maybe just isn't being stimulated. And I think the other is there's a little intimidation by people who are being full-time faculty or students or staff members to understand how I take this idea while I'm still kind of working and build it and develop it. And how can I get assistance to do that? And that's what this does, kind of helps overcome that. This isn't just money. It's actually steps and milestones and then kind of mentoring through the process of taking that idea from something you've kind of developed either in the classroom or in your lab or in your living room and moving it along and having someone help you do that with these pieces of money that come along as part of that. So that kind of goes along with the gaps that they just described.
Are we talking about people who don't necessarily see themselves as entrepreneurs in their existing field who might need the assistance to make that leap to entrepreneurship?
I don't know that it's necessarily that, and I'm sorry if I made that seem what I was trying to say. Some people don't. Some people are intimidated by the whole process of what do I do next, and do I really want to leave my job? This just gives them the chance to explore that. So I think we don't know what that ratio would be between people who have ideas that they just want to get out there and maybe allow someone else to do something with, or they themselves may want. That's one thing we're going to learn about this as we go through a year or two of this and kind of see what that ratio is between people who do want to take their idea and go with it, or other people who want to just watch an idea and help stimulate that idea into a commercial product or service.
And I think there's been some focus in the past on efforts to sort of connect the scientific, you know, or the faculty community with kind of the business community. You've seen some efforts to try to make that link, because not all researchers are interested in developing a business as a result of their work, and that's okay. As Mark said, this is about the opportunity to take that if the desire exists and all the other factors are in place for them to have that opportunity to market whatever it is that they've created. Very often, the people in the lab, they don't have the experience or the know-how, that business connection. And while Idea Advance is, of course, a seed fund, as Mark said, it's more than that. It's also about giving them the know-how to take their idea to develop a market for it, or to understand if there even is a market for it, and then to take those steps throughout the process to develop that into a business.
I gather this is the first of its kind in Wisconsin, but there are models elsewhere that exist of programs like this?
That's right. I mean, certainly on the coasts, there are big funds available for this type of activity. You know, you can name the Stanfords and the MITs and all the other institutions that exist. They're also even closer to home. You know, Minnesota's been doing this for a short while, and the UW system takes a backseat to nobody in the amount of research dollars that come in. So that speaks to what we think is the opportunity also that exists in creating something like this. Now, at $2 million, you know, we're very excited about this. This is new. This is exciting. This is something that's really going to advance business creation in Wisconsin, but it's, you know, modest compared to some of those other states. So we see this as the start of something that I think, you know, has the potential to really flourish over time.
Where this may be a new trend is that while there have been funds like Dace is on both coasts and a lot of other areas, having the money first is really important. But putting some form and function around and milestones of learning as you disperse those funds and being much more confident that there's a commercializable idea as you go through that process. I think that trend is, I wouldn't want to say this is the very first program that does this, but we're on the leading edge of kind of programs that are starting to do that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the methodology that UW Extension is going to be using with these companies is something that is fairly new, but it was developed by, it's got a wider pedigree than this, but by Steve Blank, who's a serial entrepreneur. He teaches at Stanford. He's world-renowned in this field. UW Extension is going to be a leader in providing this training to the entrepreneurs that come through this program, and that does make it innovative. Although the dollar amounts may be modest, I think everything else that Extension is bringing to the table really makes it a front runner in terms of what else is going on nationwide.
How are you assessing which ideas are commercializable and grant-worthy, if you will?
Well, there's a real specific application process that will be vetted before, and there'll be interaction with those applicants as they prepare their proposals. So that's one unique thing about this, too, that you're encouraged to engage early with what we call the new idea concierge, which is, her name is Idella Wamben, and she's going to be talking with people about the appropriateness of their proposal and helping them get that ready for application. And then there's a team of people who are representing various institutions and skill sets, including other entrepreneurs, sitting on a committee who will evaluate these according to very specific criteria. But it will be fun for us to do this. I'm on this on that committee, and it will be different than a traditional investment committee, because what we're really looking at is the idea and whether or not that idea warrants more investigation. Rather than looking at a business plan and the return of investment, we're looking at the idea and saying, can that idea be explored and turned into something different?
But let me ask this. I mean, there are some, I mean, this is a public effort, and there are some who have pointed to other public efforts and said that, you know, the government shouldn't be in the business of picking winners and losers. Is this a case of the public sector playing a role that the marketplace could be?
Well, I think the market will ultimately pick the winners and losers. This is probably at the very beginning stages of ideas, and we want to make sure we blanket all types so that these are not just technology ideas. They could be all types of ideas in healthcare and different things, so non-technical to technical. And I think that it's just to kind of get them ready for investment. And that's where the market then just jumps in. This is just to kind of build up an idea to see if there's merit there to actually put it in a form to actually take it to investors. So the winners and losers aspect is still going to be further down the chain, in my opinion, developed by the market.
Can you give us some examples of either real-world ideas in other states that have come to fruition through a program like this, or hypotheticals you might imagine in Wisconsin? And just give us a flavor for some kind of idea advance might benefit.
I had a couple that I used before, and these are more hypothetical. But one might be, let's just say, an art instructor who specializes in oil painting comes up with a recipe for a plant-based paint that has special qualities that either is used in certain type of paints and wants to develop that recipe and the commercialization of that new paint in the art world. So that would be one. Or let's say a nursing student has figured out a new way to have an attachment to a crutch that allows for more mobility for certain kinds of patients. But if they just take and tweak the design of a crutch or add this new attachment to it, it would increase the mobility of the patient. Or maybe a staff member who works in a lab and kind of operates all the equipment in the lab figures out a new way to use a motion detector to work on lab experiments while other people aren't present. So there becomes this new lab product that could be marketed across the country in certain types of lab based on motion detection equipment. So just ideas like that.
Is this up and running today? Are people who have these ideas, are they already able to access this program?
Just started, and it's just been announced a couple of weeks ago. But it is now open for business in terms of just starting to have these conversations. Applications can start coming in March, but I can tell you that there have been already 60 inquiries into that website and into the idea concierge to discuss options and proposals. And so people are already pinging it to see if they might qualify, if their ideas are interesting, and how the program works. So it is running, but the first set of awards won't be given until late April.
Well, very good. Mark Lang and David Voles, thanks so much for explaining this to us, and best of luck with the program as it goes forward.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Lang is Executive Director of the Entrepreneurship and Economic Development Division for UW Extension. David Voles manages the Entrepreneurship Program at the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. There's a link to more about the Idea Advance Seed Fund at wuwm.com/lake effect. A charter school serves a largely Spanish-speaking population on Milwaukee's south side. We'll hear how it's evolved in a decade when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. 2014 is a significant year for a charter school on Milwaukee's south side. It's the end of the first decade of existence for La Causa Charter School, which now teaches more than 800 students in two campuses from grades 4 to 8. It's chartered by Milwaukee Public Schools. More than half of the school's students are not proficient in English when they come to the school. But while English language instruction represents a substantial part of the school's mission, especially in the early grades, school leaders point to programs in fine arts and vocational education and to family involvement as what distinguishes the school. Maria Ayala-Smith is the principal. She spoke with Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce recently and looked back at the school's beginnings.
We are a non-instrumentality charter with Milwaukee Public Schools, and there were very few Milwaukee Public School charters at that time. And, of course, the vibe was of uneasiness, as I think it still is, around charter schools. La Causa Charter School sits in the middle of the Hispanic community. And so there are many children who are English language learners who needed a place where they could come to be able to learn and to be able to retain their native language. And so La Causa was able to offer its doors and open that type of programming for those children.
What was the founding principle of La Causa, and how has that evolved over the last decade?
Well, when the school opened up, the focus of the school was on bilingual education as a transitional program and an entrepreneurship. So the school had a bilingual program where the children were taught in Spanish up until second grade, and then they were transitioned into English, and the Spanish was dropped, and the children continued to learn in just English. And also they had the entrepreneurship part of it, in which there was a store of Mexican imports and the children were taught about business education. Over the years, it has evolved, and now we have a developmental bilingual program where the children are started off in Spanish. They are transitioned into English at the end of second grade. But then we maintain both languages so that we don't give up one language for the other. And so our children are able to maintain their Spanish and develop their English all the way up to eighth grade. So that's the beauty of our school, is that we're able to really produce bilingual individuals. We have also changed our other focus into a fine arts and vocational education focus. We know that children learn differently and that they have different interests. And we feel that it is our responsibility to find out what those strengths the children have. So we offer a fine arts program that includes music, it includes art, it includes a language lab. And we also offer vocational education, where we offer robotics, Project Lead the Way, video production. And so the children are able to go into those areas and find the one that really calls to them. And that really challenges the children, it engages the children, and it gives them a reason to come to school other than just to sit in their regular classrooms.
More than reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Exactly. And it's really a way of putting that into work. So what you learned in your math class, now you put it to practice in your Project Lead the Way class, building buildings or roller coasters or whatever it is you're going to build that day. But you're really putting what you learn into practice.
How does this set them up for education later on, not only high school, but perhaps college or going to a technical school?
Yes. And right now, as probably many people know, STEM is the big word out there. You know, we want to prepare our children to go into the science, technology, and math fields. And so the high schools are offering comprehensive programs. So we are hoping to prepare our children and get them started, that is an interest that they have. We give them the starting tools, so that when they're ready to go to high school, they can look for those classes and they can sign up to take those courses, which then, of course, prepares them for when they go on to college. They have an understanding of what the field is so that it's easier for them to make a decision as to what field to go into. And we're hoping that we have many of our students, especially our Latina girls, who start going into the math and the sciences classes.
That's been especially a challenge, and I know there are several programs in Milwaukee aimed toward girls and young women to get into these fields. Does it become even more challenging for girls who are Latina?
Well, I could tell you that in our school, it doesn't, because all of our children have an opportunity. And since we start them when they're younger and we kind of give them a taste of the classes when they're in our younger grades, by the time they're in middle school in 6th, 7th, and 8th, they make a decision as to what classes they want to take. So there are some children who lean toward the arts, and there's some that lean toward the STEMs. And I could tell you that our girls, once they get to that point, are confident because they know what the classes entail. They know what's going to be expected of them, and they don't hesitate in signing up for those classes.
Obviously, this is how the programs have developed at La Causa over 10 years. What have been some of the challenges in getting to where you are today?
I think some of our challenges have been the funding piece. Charter schools are not given the same type of funding that traditional schools are, but we are expected to perform as well or even better than how they perform. And so all of that costs money, you know, resources, finding the most qualified individuals to teach, all of that costs money. Another challenge has been that 55% of our children are English language learners. And that is our mission. That is who we're here to serve, those children. But of course, you know, when the state test is given to us in third grade and they have to take it in English and we just transition them in second grade, well, that poses a huge problem for us, you know. But we see it as another opportunity to learn and to grow and to strategize as to what are we going to do about this. We have these children who we know are going to be tested in third grade in English. How do we prepare them better? How do we get them ready for those tests? And not forgetting the overall development of the child, where we still have to make sure we're getting those arts and that music, all those STEM classes in, so we're developing the whole child.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the challenges, given that so many people who maybe are critical of charter schools talk about how charters have more flexibility in utilizing and rearranging their resources than traditional schools, that they can, quote, cherry pick the students that they serve. Yet you're saying it's the opposite of the truth.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we are a public school. We do not close our doors to any child. And if that was the case, I probably wouldn't be there because we're here to serve all of the children in Milwaukee. And so, no, now I can't speak for other charter schools and how they operate. I can only speak to the Lacausa Charter School, and our doors are open to anyone that comes in. When we have an over-enrollment in a certain grade level, we hold a lottery. And that's how our children get accepted into our school, through the lottery system. So we don't pick our children and we don't select the ones that are fluent in English or that already have high scores. No. We don't select those children. We have a lottery process.
Has that been an additional challenge dealing with some of that debate over the role of charter schools within public school systems?
For us as a Milwaukee Public School, non-instrumentality school, that's really not a debate. You know, that is what we do. We know that this is what we have to do, and that's part of our contract, that we don't discriminate against any children. It's morally and ethically, you just don't do that.
But I wonder if it's been difficult over the years to develop the program as robustly as you've been able to. You know, when it comes to convincing people that you may be a little bit different, but you are a public mm-hmm. school and that this yes. is your mission.
Yes, definitely it has been a challenge. It has been a challenge because a lot of things. One of the things is getting high-quality personnel to come and work at the school. That has been a challenge for us. You know, there has been turnover in staff. And I think that now that we have really defined ourselves, have a clear vision, a clear mission in place, I think that now we're getting the commitment of our staff to stay. They know where we're going. They know how we're trying to get there. And so I think in the past, when it wasn't so clear, people had more of a tendency to go and find employment somewhere else, where now people are more dedicated to what we're trying to accomplish. And knowing that the results are, we're not going to see them right away. And that's another difficulty, you know, because people get discouraged. The report card comes out and we're like, oh, my goodness. But we have to look at the value added piece. We have made a huge difference in our children. We may not be able to see it all right now, but we know that with the work that we're doing, there's nowhere to go but up. We will be seeing those results. But where we started to where we're at, you know, has been quite a journey.
And obviously, you've been open now for 10 years, which is a huge accomplishment when so many charter schools do face problems, even close after only a few years. What do you think it's been about Lacausa and what you've done there that has helped it stay so successful as it's been, even despite the challenges?
We have had our number of challenges. And I think that we talk about how our program has evolved. It has evolved because of the challenges that we have faced and because we take a look at what are the needs of our community, what are the needs of our children, and how do we better prepare them. Then we take action and we make some changes. And I think that that's what is going to sustain us, is really looking at our data, looking at our students, looking at our clientele, our parents, our community, and seeing what is it that we're going to do to be able to meet their needs. And so we can't stay with what is just because it is, but we have to evolve and we have to change. That's why we have been successful, because we have been innovative, because we have changed with the times, because we've been able to look at our students, see what they need, and then strategize to meet those needs.
What would you say would be the biggest lesson that other schools looking at Lacausa could take from the experience you've had over the last 10 years?
Well, I think the first thing is really to take a look at your program and take a look at what is your vision and your mission. Because everything you do has to revolve around that vision and that mission. This is who you are. And once you find out who you are and what you're there for, then you can surround yourself with people who are also in line with this. For me, it's been about surrounding myself with talent. We are so many talented individuals at our school who offer so much. And so it's not me just leading the school. It's all of us leading the school. And so when you get all of these talented people in the room who all bring their area of expertise and everybody has a say, we can really plan for some good things to happen at the school. And then I think also you have to bring your parents on board. They are the ones that chose to put their children in your school. We have to offer parent workshops. We have to give parents a voice so that when we task them to do something, they know how to do it. They know how to help their children. If charter schools would take a look at all those things, you know, and which has been difficult. I mean, it's been a challenge for us. You know, bringing parents in is not easy. But if we really say that's an important goal for us and we do it, you can really count on having some good successes.
You've talked before about having flexibility and room to innovate has been one of the benefits of being a charter school versus a traditional school. Can you lay that out a little bit more for me? I mean, how does La Causa as a charter school differentiate from a traditional MPS school?
Mm-hmm. I could start with our bilingual program, where it's a developmental program. Now, we're not the only ones to have a developmental program. However, we took what was given to us and we looked at it and said, okay, is this going to work well for our kids or do we need to tweak it and change it? And that's what we did, just because of the demands with the testing and everything else. And looking at where our kids are at and how much language they already bring with them, we were able to modify that so that it fits more in line to what we're trying to do. So that's one area, bringing in the fine arts and vocational education program and making it fit with what's going on in the classroom. That's another way of bringing education to the kids, but through a different venue.
So it's really about having that choice in programming and tweaking the programming as you go along.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's for our school. You know, other charter schools have a different focus. They have a different way of doing things. They have different clientele. And so that flexibility may look different for them. But for us, this is what it is.
And these are things that increasingly we're not finding in traditional MPS schools due to budget cuts and other concerns.
Correct. And that is such a shame because our children need those ways to be able to express themselves. And so when we offer this, you all of a sudden see a child who may be quiet in the classroom, but when they're in their music class, they're outstanding, the talents that they show. And so it's a shame when we see those programs being cut, we're really cutting the way that children can demonstrate their abilities. At our school, it is so important to us that even in our after-school program, we have a focus in arts. We have, at our school, guitarras latinas. Again, our culture has to be infused in everything that we do. We do the Puerto Rican cuatros. We have a trumpet ensemble. We have a dance group. We have a choir. On top of that, we offer soccer, which is huge in the Latino community. From first grade on, we have soccer teams. You know, all of those things which, again, develop the whole child.
What do you think the next 10 years will hold for La Causa?
Wow, I see great things happening at La Causa. The way that we have structured ourselves, we're really looking at data. We look at all of the data that comes our way. We take it apart. We put it back together. Teachers collaborate. They meet after school to review the data and use it to plan for instruction with our academic coaches leading us. Everybody in their area of expertise, I have a literacy coach, I have a math coach, an ESL coach, a special education coach, and an instructional coach that works with K-4 and K-5. With them leading us, we're going to go places. And our school has very low mobility. We have 3% mobility a year. That these are our children, and our children stay with us. So when we're starting them in K-4, and I could tell some of our K-4 students are already reading. In this developmental bilingual program, when they're learning to read in Spanish, they transition into English, and then they're functioning in both languages. All we can say is we're going to see good things happening from our school. I'm very confident of that.
Excellent. Well, Maria Ayala-Smith, thank you so much for coming in, and congratulations on 10 years.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Maria Ayala-Smith is principal at La Causa Charter School, an MPS charter school on Milwaukee's South Side. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. The school marks its 10th anniversary this year. A recent book seeks to be the definitive guide to fun in Milwaukee County parks. We'll learn about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Last month, fans of Sheridan Park in Cudahy got together to kick off the start to the park's centennial year. Antoinette Vanook was one of them. She's vice chair of the Friends of Sheridan Park. Earlier this winter, Vanook met WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz at Sheridan Park next to its ice skating rink inside what some call the warming house. But Vanook prefers the term pavilion. She grew up in Cudahy, raised her family there, and today lives within eyeshot of the park. Bentz and Vanook were also joined by photographer and writer Barbara Ali, a Milwaukee resident who recently wrote 101 Things to Do in Milwaukee Parks. Antoinette Vanook kicks off their conversation recalling early memories of Sheridan Park.
I didn't live as close to the park as I do now, and so our trips to the park were a little bit farther and fewer between, but when we came, we would be here for the whole day. So if we went to the pool to go swimming, we would end up staying afterwards and play in the park until it got dark and until it had to be time to go home. Then as a teenager, I lived a block and a half away from the park, and so we spent a lot of time in this building, warming up and on the ice, falling down. And then as an adult, after we got married and we had our children, we would come here. The Cudahy 4th of July parade ends here every single year. And so this place is just awash in people. You can't park six blocks away from the park. It's that packed. They have games for kids. They have food. The Lions Club have stuff set up. The city puts up a stage. Parks provide the venue, and the city provides everything else. And this year, because of the centennial, they always pick a different theme every year. Part of the theme of the parade is the Sheridan Park Centennial.
When summer does come.
When summer does come, yes. Yes. It amazes me. The fact that I live kitty corner from what I refer to as the pond, we see weddings here on weekends, you know, and people coming in and standing up on the hill and up on the bluff up there getting their pictures taken. I've walked my dog through the park, and, you know, this pavilion on weekends, usually during the summertime, has got somebody doing something every single weekend. You have picnic areas. I think there's five designated picnic areas, and there's always signs at every single one of them where the spots are reserved. People say to me, you have this huge house, and there's just you and your husband. Why do you still own this huge house? You should go into a condo. You should go in an apartment type of thing. Well, we have four children. We have seven grandchildren, all 6 years and younger. And so when they all come to visit, this is the first place we all go. Even during the winter, we watched our grandsons a year ago over the Christmas holidays, and we brought them into the park, and they trudged around in the snow, and they thought it was so neat because it had just started to freeze. We didn't have a lot of snow then, and we walked them along the edge of the lagoon, and they could actually see through the ice, and they just thought that was the neatest thing. And, you know, if you don't have parks, you can't do that.
When did you become an official?
We started this 2009, 2010, and it started out with just a half a dozen women and my husband.
What brought you together? What was the issue?
Just the fact that a lot of us walk our pets through the park, and we were tired of the fact that things were a mess. Nothing was cleaned up. Nobody was doing anything. One of the great things about friends groups is they work as a partner with the parks department. They try to pick up where the parks department can't be. At one time when I was, as I was saying before, when I was a kid and I spent time in the parks, you always had dedicated people who were the people who were in the park every single day. You knew their name, they knew your name. They were here all the time. Pavilions were open all the time. The swimming pool was open in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening. It closed for an hour at lunch and an hour at supper time, and that was it. Well, because of budget constraints, because of lack of workers, et cetera, a lot of that has had to change. You now have these people having to work their way through five or six or seven different parks. We try to be the eyes and the ears that they can't have here at all times. We've been known to walk around with plastic bags, not only to pick up after our pets, but to pick up garbage and trash. At one time during the winter, the parks departments would pick up at the first sign of snow, would pick up all of the trash cans and would take them and put them away because no one was using the parks why do you want to leave trash cans out? I mean, they can blow around, they can get damaged. And as the park started being used more and we started noticing the one or two places where we could find a trash can, they were being filled to the brim, we would contact the park and we'd say, hey, look, is there any chance we could get a trash can over by the pavilion, or can we get a trash can over by the pond? And so they've done that. As a result, the parks are cleaner. We do that type of thing. A couple of months ago, I called Matt Collins, who's in charge of this area, to let him know that walking my dog, I noticed one of the windows was broken. Not only was the screen down and torn, the window was open, and of course, I wasn't about to come over here, so I informed him. We found out that someone had broken in. So that's what I meant by we're the eyes and the ears for the parks. We try to help them out as much as we can.
So Barbara Ali wrote a book about Milwaukee's green spaces, including Sheridan. So you've mentioned some of the things in this park in your book, including ice skating.
Right, you can ice skate, and the sunrise is fantastic from the shore, if you can risk it, heading down that S road like you talked about.
You've taken the S.
I have, yes, and it's pretty slippery this time of year, but it's worth it. It's beautiful.
What started your adventure in exploring Milwaukee's green spaces, including this park?
Well, I had a son with Down syndrome, and I joined a park group, and every Friday we would meet at a different park during the summer. So it started out like most moms with parks and playgrounds and picnics. But as we got out into the parks, we discovered that there were lagoons and beautiful trees and birds and bicycles and trails, and it just seemed like every time we got into a park, we discovered something new. And there were so many things, even though we had lived all over the world, that made me go, wow, what a great place this is. And then we started to investigate how many parks there were. And each place was a little bit different. And it just gives you a wide variety here in Milwaukee. We are very fortunate.
So how long was this book in the making?
Well, I had been writing a blog for just over a year, so I had a lot of information and a lot of photographs. And then just putting it all together took about a month.
Wow.
It's amazing when your kids are in school and your husband goes on a business trip, how driven you can be to use that time that you have that's quiet. So that's what happened, and that's how it happened.
What are some of your favorite finds or, you know, real treasures that you treasure?
Well, I think if you've ever been to South Shore Park on a Saturday morning, there is just nothing like it. There's the farmer's market and music and stunning views and a little free library and playground, and there's just such a sense of community, and I think that's what keeps people coming back to parks like that. It's not just the green space, it's the community gathering there that makes it wonderful.
The photography in your book is lovely. And you decided on all black and white. Was that a cost issue or just sheer beauty?
It is, right. I want my book to be a resource guide. I want it to be something you keep in the glove box or in your backpack and write notes in. And I mean, it's meant to be used. It's not meant to be a coffee table book. And in order to keep the costs down, the pictures had to be in black and white.
So what you do is you take the reader alphabetically by activity.
Right.
How did you decide to take that approach?
Well, I think there are some great resources out there already that tell you where the parks are, and they tell you what is in the park. But what I find is that people don't have an idea of the variety of activities that can be done here. And I think a lot of them you don't discover unless you're there at a certain time or a member of a group. And this is a perfect blend of concessions and volunteers and park facilities in this area. So this kind of leads you to those concessions and the activities that are led by volunteers.
Antoinette Vanook is vice chair of the Friends of Sheridan Park. Barbara Ali is author of 101 Things to Do in Milwaukee Parks. They spoke with Susan Bentz. You'll find out more about Sheridan Centennial and Ali's book on our website, wuwm.com/lake effect. Next on the program, we go toe-to-toe with our fitness contributor for a conversation about foot health. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Think about what your feet go through every day. It's not a pretty sight. Uncomfortable shoes, bad diet, plain old neglect. Seriously, when was the last time you thought of keeping your feet in shape? Our fitness contributor says, well, it's about time. And it's about more than keeping them looking nice or flip-flop ready. Ken Weber tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon that often as go the feet, so go the rest of our body.
What's going on with our aches and pains in our bodies? How do we feel after sleeping all night when we get up and try to stretch or try to get ready? After a long drive in the car, how does our back feel? After a semi-long walk? Or what's the cold weather effect on our bodies? And the main question is, as we get older, do we feel as good as when we used to feel at our prime? And also, as a bodybuilder, I have to be really aware of aches and pains and tight muscles. I have to take care of my body between workouts so I have the optimum workout. And that's why we're going to start with our feet today and go on from there.
Before we get to the feet, I just want to ask, how do you know if some of these aches and pains just come along with getting older versus lifestyle or other concerns? Or would you say that you really shouldn't be having these aches and pains as you get older?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. As we age, we can't use that as an excuse. We need to be more aware of our body, and something hurts on our body. We have to not just ignore it or put a shoe or a sock on our feet and say, oh, it'll go away when I put my shoes on. We have to address that. It can be from injuries. It could be from wearing crazy styled shoes in our past. It could be from old injury from a sport, as I said before. It could be many reasons. But the main idea here is getting rid of those and addressing them and finding out why and where.
And sitting at your desk all day, which younger people don't necessarily do all day.
Correct.
All right. Well, what about the feet? Unless you have foot pain or blisters or anything like that, you really don't think about your feet that much.
Exactly. And our feet are our foundation. They're our basement for our house. They can cause ailments up the ladder, knees, hips, even back pain. If our feet are out of whack and we're compensating and not putting the proper balance on the foot, all kinds of stuff can happen.
Now, are you talking about not necessarily cleanliness or anything like that? You're talking about wearing the right shoes and walking the right way. And of course, I think people ignore their feet when it comes to working out as well.
Correct. As I touched on the shoe styles back in the 70s, it was the platform shoes. In the 80s that came the narrow cowboy boot. And this may not cause any problems while you're doing it, but down the road, things may come up like bunions, calluses, corns, falling arches from going barefoot too much. So these are things that could even be inherited. Bunions could be from a bad shoe or actually a hereditary problem. So many different things could be wrong with the foot, and even circulation. If your feet are cold, that can be a problem too.
Are you suggesting we all wear athletic shoes? Or are there better options these days in non-athletic shoes?
I suggest we do both. It's a very good question. The latest craze are these barefoot shoes, or what they call toe shoes. And they can be very therapeutic because they're allowing the palm of the foot or the ball of the foot to get massaged and worked while you're walking. So it's good to have good support when you're on a long hike. You want a good arch support and good balance and spread in your foot position. But it's also good to go barefoot and feel that earth on our feet or the toe shoes to actually utilize the feet like our hands.
For those that have walked around barefoot just briefly, even at the beach, it feels weird, doesn't it? You're kind of missing the thing we've gotten used to, the shoe, and your foot just lands differently on the ground when you're going barefoot. So is that actually better for you, do you think? Or do you have to make some kind of adjustment to the way you walk when you don't use shoes?
If you're having foot problems, it's best to get checked out by a professional, and they kind of test to see how you walk. Some of these places make you step on an ink blot, and it's going to show you where your pressure is. So that's a good indication on you're doing something wrong, but that can be corrected through an arch support. So you actually get the balance you need in your shoe to adjust your walking so that it's at your optimum level. And going barefoot in the sand or barefoot on the grass, it feels so good because also you're getting that earthing effect. You're getting the negative ions put through the body. That allows the body to absorb that. Those are the ions that are in the air just after a real good thunderstorm.
Well, let me just ask, since we're talking about body awareness, what should people be looking for? Is it always going to be foot pain? It can cause back pain. It can lead to other things that you don't really associate with feet.
First, what you want to do is when you're having that kind of pain, check your feet. Go to a professional podiatrist or check out one of these stores that sell arch supports. They're very, very helpful. And they are going to let you know what is going on with your foot. That's the first step. Other measures we can take in the morning is I massage my feet with my thumbs, get deep into the foot and the toes, and just the touch from your hands on your feet is going to be very soothing on either dry skin, poor circulation, or in those metatarsals, those fine bones in the ball of our feet. We can manipulate that with our hands if we take the time to really, really explore and go in between each toe, touch each toe, which I've ignored in the past. And I've just started doing this about, I'd have to say 5 weeks ago, and I've noticed a difference on how good my feet and toes feel.
And is that just part of increasing circulation to your feet?
Yeah. When we have injuries, poor shoes, whatever reason, our circulation, our muscles, and our nerve fibers in our feet become bound up. And what should really happen in your feet is you should have space. That's why yoga is so important and stretching and chiropractic manipulation. It causes space between the bones. Those tiny muscles are very hard to release on their own. So you get in there, massage them, and that creates the space we need for comfort in the ball of our foot. And then the circulation and the nerves can work at a better pace. Your feet are going to turn from cold to very warm, and they become your friends. They become part of your body again.
Besides blisters, maybe you can tell us more about blisters and how to avoid them or how to deal with them. But what are some things that people need to be aware of when they're working out so they don't damage their feet?
Whenever you get a new shoe, yeah, that's a very common thing that happens. A blister will occur and it's just not broken into the shape of your foot yet. It's something that may alter the way you walk for a while and cause a foot to overwork on the other side, or your body alignment as you walk or work out will be off. It's best to keep it dry and clean and let it just take its course, let it heal. Cover it while you still have your shoe on, but let it get some open air and let that heal. It's a very painful thing to have, and if you're running a marathon and get one, it's like you trudge through it to finish, but you got to take care of that after that occurs.
Just an observation. I see so many people that wear athletic shoes to work and then they change shoes at work. Is it really that much of a either-or situation? Are there really no shoes that you can wear to work that are actually good for your feet? Or are people that are wearing athletic shoes to work and then are they onto something?
You can wear your dress shoe if you have the proper arch support. And maybe some people like the tennis shoe because of the grip and because of the comfort walking into their job and don't have to deal with the hard leather or the high heel. So they're on to more comfort while they're walking or getting to work, and keeps your good shoes clean too. But a tennis shoe is generally more comfortable. But a person that has their arch support in place that needs it can wear either shoe.
Just to follow up to that even, which is we all know people that have dozens, if not more, pairs of shoes. Is it possibly detrimental if you have that many pairs of shoes because your feet have to get used to them all over again every time you change shoes? Or is it better to have a few pairs, maybe five at the most, that you wear all the time so that you don't have to keep readjusting to shoes so quickly and frequently?
The answer, it's a tough one for me because of the fact I do use supports. I've been using them for 15 years, and I do switch them into the shoe I'm wearing. Now, people that don't need them, yeah, the shoe is going to be a little different. So I would think that the best answer would be a comfortable shoe that you really have to plan for your day. How long are you going to be walking? How long are you going to be in them? And if you want the dressy one, maybe you'll wear that when you're not on your feet so much. So it depends on how long you're going to be in that shoe.
Anything else people can do at home to address foot issues, if you will, or just keep their feet in good shape?
One other thing I do is I roll on a lacrosse ball. You can start with a tennis ball and just support one hand and kind of use one foot at a time and roll that on the bottom of your foot, the ball of your foot, your toes, and repeat with the other foot. And also, I use a PVC pipe to roll on with my foot, And the second thing I do is I use one foot, one heel, to use as pressure on the top of the other foot when I'm barefoot. And I use one heel to massage the other foot to work out any kind of tightness, nerve bundles, or muscle tightness on the opposite foot. So you can use props, you can use your own feet, and you can use your thumbs and hands. So a lot of things you can use to keep your feet in good shape.
And for those that are into the spa lifestyle, I would assume a foot massage is probably a really good idea.
Absolutely. A foot massage that's done by a professional that knows the foot bones, not just a foo-foo one to rub, but to really get in between those metatarsals and on top of the foot, in between the toes, and work it all the way down, and actually one toe at a time. And you'll notice when you do this yourself or through a foot massage, your skin will no longer be callous or dry or hard. All those little ailments on your toes and heels will start to go away.
We didn't talk about diet, but I just have to ask if there's anything that we should or shouldn't be eating to help our feet. I mean, obviously, people that have gout know what they can and can't eat, but what if you don't have that and just kind of a general health as far as feet?
I'm noticing the better I eat, the better my muscles perform, the better I can actually work on my feet, and I have the ability to have that supple area of muscle. And what I mean by supple, if you take a water balloon and fill it about halfway with water and feel the texture of that water in the balloon, that's the way our muscles should feel. And our feet should feel very pliable, very spongy, and very, very workable. So what I do is I eat as raw and unprocessed as possible. In my salad that I have at noon, it's huge. It's a big Jethro salad bowl, about the size of a big popcorn bowl, full of just fresh vegetables and lettuce and spinach. And I make that a priority. If I eat raw and unprocessed, my muscles, my feet, my body feel better. My energy is a whole lot better. And when you eat too, I always thought it was many, many small meals. But I'm finding out that if I eat between 12 and 8 and do a form of intermittent fasting, that my body likes that a whole lot better. And cut the caffeine out. Skip the coffee shop and go to get yourself a nice green drink, a green smoothie or a shot of wheatgrass. You'll notice a big difference in your level of energy.
Okay, and you know we're going to be kind of moving up the body in the next year as far as body awareness, and not every time, but you know as we decide we want to talk about it. So I think next time we're going to talk about awareness of your legs.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ken.
You're welcome, Dan.
Ken Weber owns Brickyard Gym in Bayview, and he's our monthly fitness contributor. He spoke with Dan Harmon about foot health. It is apparently a subject that resonates with Minnesota singer-songwriter Peter Himmelman as well. We leave you today with his song, appropriately called Feet. I'm sure you'll find that song a kick. I'm Mitch Teich. I'm going to walk on out of here. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock. My feet like to swim and jump around.